I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to Radio Times. There's been a torrent of economic and financial news recently. J.P. Morgan Chase lost something like $3 billion in risky trades, raising some troubling questions about the lessons not learned after the 2008 financial collapse. Europe is still grappling with the euro crisis, and it could be deja vu all over again when it comes to a fight in this country over raising the debt ceiling. Well, here to talk about all of this, as well as his plan to get the economy moving again, is Paul Krugman, author of a new book called End This Depression Now! He won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2008, writes a twice-weekly column for the New York Times. He's a professor of economics at Princeton University and joins us from Princeton University's Broadcast Center. Paul Krugman, it's been about 5 years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi there.
How are you doing?
I'm all
in that
right.
Windowless room.
Day. And it's stuck in a windowless room, as are you.
I share your pain. Let me begin with J.P. Morgan Chase. And Jamie Dimon said last weekend that the bank's behavior was stupid and sloppy. What would you call it?
But, you know, that happens all the time. I mean, there, you know, stupidity is part of life. The trouble is that J.P. Morgan is not just some investor. J.P. Morgan is a strategically significant financial institution. If it gets in trouble, as with any large bank, it can do a lot of damage to the economy. It's an institution that has guaranteed deposits that are guaranteed by the taxpayer. It's an institution that you know would be bailed out if it got into really deep trouble. So when it does stuff that is sloppy and stupid, it is in effect gambling with your money and your economy. And this is why we need stronger bank regulation, which is, of course, what Jamie Dimon has been campaigning against.
Is $3 billion a big loss for J.P. Morgan Chase?
Not in itself. I mean, it's a huge amount of money. But J.P. Morgan is not in trouble because of this. But the point is that J.P. Morgan, which was supposedly acting prudently and, in fact, supposedly not doing risky trades with depositors' money, turns out to have been, guess what, doing exactly what it said it wouldn't do. So that's the point. It's not that this particular event is actually going to bring down the world financial system. It is showing that the banks have learned nothing. And it is showing that unless we regulate them effectively, they will do exactly the same things that brought us into the crisis last time.
I don't want to get too wonky here, but what is the difference between hedging, which is in a way managing risks, and things like gambling or speculation?
I mean, a hedge is supposed to be – look, if a farmer has got a wheat crop and the farmer enters into a futures contract to guarantee the price at which he or she can sell that wheat, that's hedging. If somebody who has got no connection with the agricultural industry buys or sells some wheat futures, just making a bet on the future price of wheat, that is gambling, right? So that's the difference. And what J.P. Morgan was supposedly doing, allegedly, was it was simply hedging. It was simply taking some aspects of his business and doing some contracts that would ensure that if the market didn't go the way everyone expected, it would be okay. But that wasn't what it was doing. What it was actually doing was taking a big gamble that went wrong.
Dodd-Frank, and it's frankly still being written, but is there anything in Dodd-Frank that would have prevented this kind of behavior?
Yeah, there is in Dodd-Frank, there is a rule that says that that depository institutions with federal guarantees like J.P. Morgan, are not supposed to do proprietary trading. They're not supposed to be – they can facilitate gambling, if you like. They can do if a client wants to speculate, they can arrange for that client to speculate. They can set up the arrangements. But they're not supposed to be speculating with their own money because they are – a federally guaranteed institution. Now, that rule is not – the actual details of that are not set, and it's not clear that J.P. Morgan was in violation of anything that has happened yet, although we'll find out. I mean, nothing is clear about this yet. But at least in principle, Dodd-Frank is supposed to prevent exactly this kind of thing.
But are we dealing with a system that is so complicated that we don't know how to manage it, we don't know what some of these big banks are doing, and we are left to pick up the pieces?
Well, this is why you establish regulations that say what they're supposed to be doing. And the regulations, of course, are going to be written partly with very specific prohibitions, but partly with things in principle so that you can go back and say, look, on any reasonable interpretation, what these guys did was a violation. And so we can come back and say that, you know, you have broken the law. and make banks. You know, it's like antitrust law. Mm-hmm. You cannot specifically prohibit meetings by the flower pot in the lobby of such and such a hotel, but you can write a law that says that businesses shall not collude on prices. And then if it turns out that some guy stood near the flower pot and whispered things about their prices, that they were in violation of the law. So this Dodd-Frank, I mean, it's not the greatest. It's not the tightest legislation I would have wanted, but you certainly can do this. I mean, we did it. For 50 years after the Great Depression, we avoided major banking crises because we had effective bank regulation. Then we decided, oh, well, that's a relic. We don't really need that anymore. And sure enough, we went back and had a replay of the Great Depression.
You're talking about Glass-Steagall. Bring it back.
Glass-Steagall and a set of other things around that. But yes, bring back Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall was the hard separation between banks that take deposits and places like Lehman Brothers that just are doing financial activities but are not banks in that sense. That was done away with in 1999. That was clearly a mistake. Bring back strong regulation of the risks depository institutions can take. And extend it, because now we have a whole bunch of things that don't look like conventional banks but are effectively banks, shadow banks. If somebody is raising money with overnight loans and then using it to finance long-term investments, that may not look like a conventional bank with a big marble building with rows of tellers, but it creates all the same risks and should be regulated the same way.
You and others have said that while all this has been going on for the last couple of years, that lobbyists working for banking institutions have been lobbying Congress to loosen some of these proposed regulations, saying essentially,
right,
trust us, we'll manage this.
Yeah, and this has been a huge pushback, and then of course the Wall Street, which by and large has traditionally kind of given more money to Democrats, I think more out of cultural affinity than anything else. Now, this time around, Wall Street is overwhelmingly supporting Mitt Romney, because Mitt Romney has promised to do away with even the very mild regulations that we have instituted. So, sure, they're pushing back against regulation. And Jamie Dimon, J.P. Morgan, as it turned out, managed to avoid getting into some of the worst bets. They didn't get into the subprime and the derivatives involving housing that nobody understood. And so they've been point man. J.P. Morgan and Jamie Dimon have been saying, oh, you know, we know what we're doing. Trust us. These regulations aren't necessary, which is why I'm actually feeling very thankful to Jamie Dimon right now for demonstrating that actually, you know what, you guys don't know what you're doing and you can create the same risks as everybody else.
In fact, he called the strategy of his own bank flawed, poorly reviewed, poorly executed, and poorly monitored.
Yeah, and of course, the point is, people have a right to be stupid, but not with taxpayers' money and not by putting the economy at risk. So, you know, if that's the way you're going to be, glad you said it. But then in that case, we really need to have some pretty stiff regulations on what you're allowed to do.
Do you think Congress, even the White House, has the appetite to take on the industry?
Well, certainly not this House of Representatives, which is completely would do its best to return. I mean, they don't just want to undo the Dodd-Frank. They want to undo everything back to the progressive era. So they certainly don't want to fix this. And the White House has been ambivalent. There have been conflicting forces within the White House. But I think the people I think of as the good guys increasingly have the upper hand.
Let me ask you about actually a piece you had today in the New York Times about the euro, and everyone is talking about Europe and the euro. Should the euro, can the euro be saved, do you think?
I think it should be, not because I think it actually was a bad idea. This was a romantic idea that they didn't really have the preconditions in place to make it work well. But it's a very big difference between not doing it in the first place. We don't have a time machine,
right,
and letting it break up. Breaking up, first of all, would be very disruptive economically in the short run, but it's also a political disaster. The European project is bringing peace, democracy, and prosperity to the continent that almost destroyed world civilization, actually twice in the 20th century.
And that's a good thing, this European project.
The European project is a good thing. Unfortunately, the euro, almost everything else that has been part of that project has actually been a really good thing. Removing borders, establishing a customs union, having harmonization of regulations, having aid to the poorest regions, those are all good things. Then they went ahead with this currency project, which turns out to be very badly flawed. But you want to try and save it. You want to try and make it work rather than see the whole thing fail. But that's going to require that they change that. Their notions, change their way of doing business, and they have to do it fast. We have very little time left.
And I mean, how would the euro be fixed? And obviously, you've got Germany on one side, you've got Spain, you've got Ireland, you've got such a mix of economies.
Yeah, although the truth is, if you looked at the United States through much of its history, it was pretty uneven too. Not that uneven, but you know, the gap in incomes between. New Jersey and Mississippi was at one point pretty wide, not as much as now because the South has gotten richer. But we have a federal government. We have institutions that provide, in effect, automatic aid. You know, when Florida goes into a terrible slump after a housing bubble, Medicare and Social Security keeps on being paid by Washington. So it's not as much of a fiscal crisis for Florida. Europe is a long way from that. What they need to do now is they need to provide an economic environment where the troubled countries at least have a chance of working their way out, which means that they actually have to have a booming economy in the rest of Europe, in the parts of Europe that are not in deep trouble. They have to have some inflation so the debt burdens get eroded over time. And so that's easier, so that Spain can become competitive not by cutting wages, but simply by having wages that don't rise while German wages do rise. So that's the way to do it. It's actually – but it requires that they be willing to say, hey, you know, all this stuff about price stability is the holy grail and all this stuff about punishing debtors because debt is sin, we can't do – if that's what you want to do, then goodbye euro and goodbye European project. And they have – again, they probably have only months to make this change.
Only months. Interesting. We're about a minute before our first break here. But when you read about Spain, where the unemployment rate, especially among young people, is something like 50%.
That's right. Spain and Greece both have 50-plus percent unemployment among the young. Think about that. They cannot survive this for very much longer.
And so, I mean, do you think there is – and I guess this gets to the – is there a political will to do what you think should be done?
It all hinges on Frankfurt and Berlin, the two centers, the European Central Bank and the German government. You know, most of the time, if I try to think it through, I don't believe that they're going to do what they need to do. But on the other hand, the prospect of hanging concentrates the mind. The prospect of a collapse of Europe may concentrate their minds.
And would certainly hurt the United States.
Well, yeah, we have it'll hurt our exports, although that's a smaller thing than people imagine. We only sell about 2% of what we make in Europe, but still. It hurt the financial markets, but also, I mean, I guess come back to the politics. Europe is our great democratic ally.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Paul Krugman, our guest today on Radio Times, professor of economics at Princeton University, author of a new book called End This Depression Now. I added exclamation point because it has an exclamation point in the title. We're going to talk about the U.S. and much more after this very short break and take some calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with continuously controlled damping, or CCD. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. On view now through June 3rd. The 111th annual student exhibition features over 1,000 works of art by PAFA's BFA, Certificate, and MFA students. The annual student exhibition showcases a diversity of style, combining traditional skill and contemporary vision. For details, 215-972-7600 or online at pafa.edu.
I'm Marty Moscowane.
I'm Terry Gross.
And I'm Dave Davies. Help WHYY celebrate 25 years of Radio Times and Fresh Air at a special live event.
Dave will ask the questions. Marty and I will have to answer them at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Philadelphia.
It all happens Monday, June 4th at 7, and you can reserve your tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
Celebrate 25 years of public media's best, Radio Times and Fresh Air.
The Philadelphia Inquirer supports WHYY. Every day, the Inquirer features stories about the people, the government, and the happenings of the Philadelphia region and beyond. Plus, augmented reality content every Sunday. The Inquirer. Your life. Your stories.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with economist Paul Krugman about the euro, J.P. Morgan Chase. We will be talking in just a moment or two about some of the ideas in his new book called End This Depression Now. I do want to get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Bruce from Berks County had a question that I had. Bruce, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks. Dr. Krugman, the narrative is that J.P. Morgan Chase lost a couple billion dollars, and I'm having a hard time understanding what that word means, lost. And it's a wonderful life. The fellow loses a bag of money, and it ends up in somebody else's hands. Where does this kind of money go on this grand scale? What does lost mean, and who finds the money, and what do they do with it?
Thank you. Bruce, go ahead, Paul Krugman.
No, they made a bet in the markets. As best I can, it's really, really having a hard time figuring out exactly what it was, but it looks as if they basically sold other people insurance that there would be no defaults and on some corporations. And those things are actually – those are marketable securities, those collateralized – sorry – whatever, the credit default swaps. I'm losing it myself.
Thank you for saying whatever, because I always feel like such
I can
idiot.
I can the alphabet soup here has gotten so thick that it's all of us lose our way. But no, it's credit default swaps and the market in effect decided that they were understating the risks. The price of those things changed, but think of it basically as it's as if you bought some stock. And the value of the stock has fallen, and you actually are forced to close out your position. So you're forced to realize that loss. That's all it was. It was just a change in asset prices because they had bet wrong against the market, which, again, happens all the time. Lots of investors lose money all the time, but most investors are not key financial institutions.
So does some bookie, using this gambling metaphor, some bookie have this money, or it just essentially disappears from –
No, we actually are pretty sure that it's the other side of this is probably some combination of individual wealthy investors and hedge funds. But the point is, somebody in the world, probably a fair bit of it not in the United States, but it doesn't matter, right? Somebody in the world made the money. But actually, this was Mitt Romney said something remarkably stupid yesterday, which was, well, they lost the money, but somebody else made the money, so yeah. What's the problem? And yeah. The answer is, well, somebody else is not a bank, right?
Interesting. Bruce, thanks for the call. Let's see what Russ from West Windsor, New Jersey has to say. And Russ, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi there.
Given the enormous financial mess of the Great Recession, all the shenanigans that went on, I was wondering if Professor Krugman was surprised about the absence of any criminal prosecutions of malefactors, like even, for example, executives of Countrywide Mortgage Company, and if he was surprised, why he thought that there haven't been indictments.
Russ, I appreciate the call, and this is a question that has dogged the collapse for a couple of years. Paul Krugman, go ahead.
Yeah. So, by the way, I've been trying to push, among other things, in the title of the new book, I've been trying to push the word depression instead of recession for a reason. It's not because I want to make it how terrible it is, though it is terrible, but because a recession is when things are going down, and a depression is when things are down. And, we've been officially out of recession since June 2009, but we're still in depression because we're still in a very depressed economy. The absence of indictments has been amazing and shocking, and it cannot be the case that there were so few people who actually broke the law. True, a lot of bad things aren't necessarily illegal, but still, and I think that it comes down to an excessive caution on the part of – a combination of the fact that a lot of our political class is still effectively in the pockets of the malefactors of great wealth, plus the fact that there was this great caution on the part of a lot of people, including a fair number of people in the Obama administration, who were so afraid of rocking the boat, of rattling confidence, that they didn't want to push hard for accountability, which I believe was a big mistake. And it may be now too late to go back. I guess we can try, but it is kind of amazing how few basically there's been nothing. And that can't – when you have a financial disaster this large, it cannot be the case that there wasn't a lot of actual lawbreaking involved.
Russ, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Well, let me talk about your book, Paul Krugman, and this depression now. As you said, depression, you use that word because you feel like that is what we're in. It's not the Great Depression of the 1930s, but it is still nonetheless a depression.
Yeah, so I think, you know, that's our wonderful, encouraging slogan for our times. Not as bad as the Great Depression. Great. I actually have it's actually kind of a double entendre, right. An economist version of a double entendre. One is the point that we're down, that even though the GDP may be growing and employment numbers may be positive, we still have mass unemployment. We still have 4 million people who've been out of work for more than a year. So it's a continuing terrible state, even if we're not technically in a recession anymore. The other is that there's a very specific way in which the rules of economic policy are very different when you're in a depressed state as we are right now. Because in normal times, you can say there's a good case for balancing budgets. There's a good case for austerity. If you want to make money has to come from somewhere. When you're in a state like this, it's not. Mm-hmm. Trying to balance the budget just makes the depression deeper. If the federal government spends more money on infrastructure or to rehire those school teachers we've laid off, that money does not actually have to come from somewhere. That money is money that would have been otherwise idle, putting to work workers who would otherwise have been idle. So we're in depression economics, which is actually the title of a previous book, and we're still in this depression. It's a terrible state, and don't let anybody tell you, well, the recession ended in 2009. That's true, but so what?
Well, let me see if in a nutshell, this is what you're saying we should do, that there is a demand problem in this economy. We're an economy that relies on consumer spending, so we don't have enough consumer spending. You want the government essentially to step in, spend more money, hire the unemployed. They begin to spend, the economy recovers, and the private sector, in a sense, can step in and carry the economy forward. Is that your formula?
Yes, it doesn't have to be. We don't necessarily rely on consumer spending, but rely on someone spending.
Right.
And if the consumers are debt-strapped and are unwilling to spend, and the businesses are unwilling to spend because they don't see the consumer demand, now is the time for the government to step in, give households a chance to repair their balance sheets, give corporations a reason to invest because they see that the economy is expanding again. And it doesn't go on forever, but it's as a transitional strategy. Now is the time, and we could be back to prosperity. We could be back to something that feels much more like full employment, faster than anyone imagines. This could be over in 2 years if only we had the political will and the intellectual clarity.
Well, the U.S. debt is something like $16 trillion. At what point do you think that number becomes unsustainable? Or is it a matter of a percentage of GDP, changes whether it's sustainable or not?
Well, certainly you want to measure it as a percentage of GDP. I mean, every number about the United States is gigantic because we're a gigantic country with a gigantic economy. As a percentage of GDP, it's higher than I would like it to be. And I wish we had come into this thing with lower debt. And I actually was, I pushed very hard saying do not cut taxes, do not wage unfunded wars, and we would have had less debt and we'd be a little easier of mind right now than we are. But historically, advanced countries which have their own currency and which borrow in their own currency are amazingly resilient in terms of carrying high debt levels. Great Britain had debt levels higher than we now have as a share of GDP for most of the 20th century. There was never a crisis. Japan has a debt level twice what we have, more than that actually, and they're still able to borrow very cheaply. So it's not an imminent crisis. The other thing you really need to say is that even if you are disturbed by the debt, saying, so let's cut spending right now, even though the economy is in a depression, is not a viable strategy because cutting spending shrinks the economy, reduces revenue, damages the economy's long-run prospects, so it reduces future revenue. And it's almost certain, given the numbers, given the low interest rates at which you can borrow, that even if you are worried about the debt, slashing spending right now is actually self-defeating. It'll actually make the debt problem worse.
Well, let me summarize Representative Paul Ryan. His philosophy is, if you shrink the government and cut government spending, then you're going to make room for private growth. The idea that when the government spends so much money, it pushes, aside private companies that want to do business in this country. Does that make any sense to you?
Not under current circumstances, for sure. I mean, what's the usual story, if you actually go back to what people like Ryan were saying 3 years ago, was, oh, all that government borrowing is going to send interest rates skyrocketing. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as of this morning, the U.S. government was able to borrow long-term at about 1.73%, right? So that clearly was wrong. They made a prediction. That prediction has been overwhelmingly rejected by events. The idea that the private sector is looking over its shoulder saying, oh, I'm not going to invest because I'm worried about that government spending, this is just not true. You can look at surveys. You can look at what business people say when they're actually asked, not in a political context, but just objectively, why are you not investing? Mm. The answer is because they don't have enough sales. And finally, what's going on in Europe? A number of European countries have been forced into harsh spending cuts. And the story 2 years ago was that not to worry. This will improve confidence. And so the private sector will more than make up the difference. That has not happened. Right? Look at the Greeks, look at the Spaniards, look at the Irish, who've done everything they were supposed to do and have got 15% unemployment and 30% youth unemployment.
And that's our guest, Paul Krugman. We are talking about the U.S. economy, the euro, J.P. Morgan Chase. He's the author of a new book called End This Depression Now, won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2008. He's a Princeton University professor, also writes a twice-weekly column for the New York Times. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Let me ask you something that actually, frankly, concerns me, which is I worry that we don't have an economy with emerging technologies and globalization that can create enough jobs for everyone who wants to work and can work and should be working. I think about some of these very successful companies. They're not Foxconns. You know, they're not hiring 250,000 people or 500,000 people. They maybe have a couple hundred employees.
Okay. And this is – there's a real concern that's in there, but it's not quite the concern the way that people usually express it. There are lots of jobs for people who don't have incredibly high skills. Those jobs are mostly in the service sector, although manufacturing is starting to stage a significant revival in this country and would do more if we expand it. But a lot of the jobs are going to be in the service sector, which is everything from healthcare, which is mostly not, you know, a prize-winning surgeons, is mostly a lot of people doing various kinds of jobs in the healthcare sector. A lot of it is in retail and distribution. The biggest employer in America is Walmart. And it's always worth remembering that even if you are buying a Chinese, you know, some Chinese plastic doodad in Walmart, most of the price, most of the value added in that thing you buy is actually domestic. It's actually U.S. distribution, the U.S. sector. Plus, again, we're a lot better at manufacturing than people think, and we are actually seeing a significant amount of reshoring in our economy. Companies moving back because they're discovering that the labor cost advantages in Asia are not as big as they thought they were, and the advantages of being close to the market, of being close to consumers, and the sophistication of the U.S. economy are all advantages. So all of these things, if you ask, in 1940, when the U.S. began its recovery from the Great Depression through government spending aimed at a military buildup, it was probably true that 95 cents of a dollar spent in America stayed in America. These days, it's probably more like 85 to 90 cents. That's not going to change. It is actually still that high. So it's actually not going to change the story as much as people think.
Well, let me just do a quick follow-up, and then we will get to some more callers here. But thinking about the jobs created in this country, especially in the service sector, if we are an economy that needs consumers who spend money beyond even what the federal government might spend, isn't that an argument for a livable wage? I mean, making sure that people don't go into debt while they try to, you know, spend money on things that they need and want.
Yeah, so, and I actually didn't get to finish what I was saying before. What is true is we do seem to be seeing a kind of hollowing out of the job opportunities out there. With the jobs that are growing fast are either relatively low wage or very high wage, and the ones in the middle seem not to be doing so well. And we want to do something about that. One of the things you can do is higher minimum wages. It's pretty clear from all the evidence I've seen that if you had a $50 an hour minimum wage, that would be a problem, but raising it from its current level would not, and it would, in fact, improve living standards and probably mean a healthier economy. You can try to create an environment where unions can once again start to organize workers and bargain for better pay and more equality, and you can make sure that we have strong social insurance so that people, even if people don't necessarily have the best jobs, they do have a guarantee that the essentials, above all health care, are going to be there for them. So I think – so this is all an argument for a bunch of things that we should be doing. Health care reform, what we got in the Affordable Care Act was not my ideal plan, but it's a start. We need to make that survive. Do a lot of these things to try and – in effect – we can try to redo what we did in the 30s and 40s, which was we took a highly polarized society and turned it into a largely middle-class society. Mm-hmm. That wasn't just something that happened because that was what the markets were or technology were doing. It was something that was the result of a favorable political environment. And I think we can do a lot of that again.
You're really calling for a second stimulus.
A second stimulus, for sure. Although it's a lot easier than the first one, right? The first one, you had to find things to spend money on. Now we can get most of the stimulus we need just by providing money to the state and local governments to rehire those school teachers and firefighters and police officers and restart those stopped infrastructure projects, start repairing the potholes. I don't know what it's like on the other side of the Delaware, but the roads here are a mess, right?
Oh,
and so we can
here as well.
So we can get, and I've actually done in End This Depression Now, in the book, I have some rough math. We can get probably $300 billion a year of extra useful spending, not by doing anything new, but just by restoring basic government services to where they were before the Great Recession struck. And that in itself is going to take us a long way back towards full employment.
About a minute before our second break, and we have a full bank of calls, and I do want to get to them after this break here. But do you think, and you have been a longstanding critic of the Republicans, but you do also criticize the Obama White House and the president himself for not being as, I guess, outspoken as you are for a need for this kind of stimulus spending?
Yeah, unfortunately, the president, he lowballed the initial stimulus, and the question about the politics, but he never made the case that it should be bigger. And for a long time, he essentially accepted the argument that now was the time to turn to austerity. Now he's gotten better. He's making a better case now than he was a year ago, and of course he's consider the alternative, right? Obama may not be saying everything I'd like him to say, but look at what the other guy is saying.
Well, let's take another break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. Paul Krugman, our guest today on Radio Times, won the Nobel Prize in Economics back in 2008. He writes a twice-weekly column for the New York Times. He's a blogger, also a professor of economics at Princeton University, author of a number of books, including a new one called End This Depression Now. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Chestnut Hill College takes a holistic approach designed to inspire a passion of learning and a rewarding educational experience. The Chestnut Hill College School of Graduate Studies. Chestnut Hill College supports WHYY.
WHYY is proudly supported by the new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro. Opening May 22nd, the new hospital is being built with all single-patient rooms and has been designed with innovations that may help improve healing and lower infections. Features include a new rapid-response emergency room and CHOP docs to care for children. The new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro, redefining care. Opening May 22nd. More at PrincetonHCS.org.
Hey everybody, Jad here. I wanted to let you know that Radiolab is coming soon to Philadelphia for a live show. We're calling it In the Dark, and it's all about darkness and light, seeing, believing. It's going to be a super fun night because we've got the comedian Dimitri Martin coming with us, the singer-songwriter Tao Nguyen, and the amazing dance troupe Palabolas. They'll all be there. We'll be there June 29th at the Academy of Music. You can get tickets at radiolab.org.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School, providing public online education for grades 6 through 12, utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Paul Krugman, who is in Princeton. We're talking about his ideas about how to get Americans back to work, how to get the economy growing again, and what we can learn from Europe. And let me get back to our callers. We've got, it looks like Zach from Mount Airy joining us on Radio Times. And Zach, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Hi, Paul. Great discussion.
Thank you.
We're really learning the wrong lesson from what's happened with J.P. Morgan here. J.P. Morgan has proven its ability to self-regulate. Its investors were very angry with what happened with its losses. The executives were fired. And I think we're talking about J.P. Morgan like it's lost a lot of money, but actually it has pulled a profit over the past year. I think it's very arrogant on our part as citizens or as congressmen to say that we know how to regulate J.P. Morgan better than its own investors and better than its own executives do.
It's a fascinating question. Zach, go ahead, Paul Krugman.
Okay, so the important point here is that J.P. Morgan is not simply acting on behalf of its investors. J.P. Morgan is an institution that is also, in effect, a public utility. It is an institution that we know, we've seen, will be bailed out if it gets into big trouble. It's an institution that already receives formal government guarantees, large government guarantees, in the form of deposit insurance. So it's not arrogant. It's saying, if you want to take those risks with your own money, fine. But don't take those risks with the taxpayers' money. Don't take those risks while running an institution that we know is going to be is an effect of public trust. So it's very different. If Facebook goes out there and loses $2 billion on something stupid, I have no problem with that. Mm-hmm. But this is a bank. This is a strategically central bank. It's a bank backed by government guarantees. So that's what makes it different. It's not me or anybody saying that we know how to invest better than the people at J.P. Morgan do. It's us saying that there are risks that you are not supposed to take because of your special position in our nation's economy.
Zach, I appreciate the call to Radio Times to see what Kyle from West Philadelphia has to say. And Kyle, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
Hi, the global derivatives market worldwide stands somewhere around $1.5 quadrillion. I believe it's from a Wall Street Journal report from 2007. J.P. Morgan losing up to $3 billion seems like a drop in the bucket when it comes to that number. I was wondering if you see this as a result of fractional reserve policies and the Federal Reserve's policy.
Thank you, Kyle. Go ahead, Paul Krugman.
So let me just say fractional reserve. Banks... Banks don't when you put money in a bank, they don't keep it all in a vault. They lend most of it out, and that means that banks are always at least a little bit vulnerable to the notion that, well, what if everybody decides to withdraw their money at the same time? And this is why this ultimately comes down to is at the root of the reason why banks are strategically significant, what the reason why they have federal guarantees, the reason why they get bailed out in crises, because fractional reserve banking is a great thing in many ways. It allows you to have liquid assets and at the same time use much of the money to invest in things that may not be that easily sold on a moment's notice. The right answer there is not – so it's actually – it's a funny thing. A number of people on the political right believe we should have gold standard, we should have minimal government, but we should ban fractional reserve banking. And it's kind of odd. They've got this one thing that happens in a market economy that they somehow think is wrong. Everything else is right, but this one thing is wrong. And furthermore, they believe you can ban it, which is actually you can't do. If you ban fractional reserve banking in depository institutions, big marble buildings with rows of tellers, all that will happen is that something, the functional equivalent of fractional reserve banking, will spill over into something else. In fact, that's already true. On the eve of this big crisis, more than half of banking in America, properly understood, was in stuff like Lehman Brothers issuing repo, which is overnight borrowing to finance investments, which for all practical purposes was the same thing as regular banking and was, of course, fractional reserve. It, most of that money was not just held in cash overnight. So you have to work with the realities of a banking system as it's actually going to function, not imagine that you can somehow legislate a banking system in which depositors' money is never at risk. And therefore, we now have no need to ever do anything else in terms of government intervention.
Kyle, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me go from quadrillion to the end of this year. Paul Krugman, the Bush tax cuts are scheduled to expire. The payroll tax cut is scheduled to expire. What should the government do, do you think? What would your advice be?
No, there's a different question. What should the government do? If we had a government, if we actually had a group of reasonable women and men who would get together and decide what to do, what they should do is they should find a way to avoid having this hit to spending power, but lock in a return to fiscal responsibility and an end to all of those tax cuts, none of which actually were justified in light of what we know now. Actually, they weren't justified in light of what we knew then, but certainly not now. But this is not a really good time for this to be happening. The real question is, what does President Obama do?
Oh, interesting.
Particularly,
okay.
If we have a reelected President Obama, what does he do? Mm-hmm. And he's going to be in the situation he's been in before, which is that he's facing a hostage crisis. That the Republicans are going to try to hold the economy hostage, saying basically, give us everything we want, or all of these innocent men, women, children, and puppies are going to get shot. And I think he has to say, no, okay, no more of that. We have a constitution. The constitution says that if you want legislation, you pass that legislation, and you either get it signed by the president or you override his veto. You don't get to hold – you don't get to play terrorist with economic policy. If this is going to be a disaster for the economy, on your head be it. And by the way, we understand you're getting a lot of money from corporate America, a lot of money from Wall Street. Let those people yank your chain and say, hey, destroying the country was not part of what we bought you for.
A couple just practical questions and we'll get back to our callers. But are you saying for instance, the Bush tax cuts, which you think were a bad idea, would you say let them expire on wealthier Americans? Or do you think the middle class still needs help?
I think that the bargaining, the goal of Obama should be to end the tax cuts on the wealthy on schedule, actually behind schedule, because they should have ended 2 years ago, but not the middle class tax cuts, because realistically I don't think he can get you do want something. We do need continuing help for middle class Americans, at least for now. The Bush tax cuts are not the right way to do that, but in practice he's not going to be able to get something better. So I would say that his ultimate goal should be just let the tax cuts at the top end expire. But what he can simply do is nothing. Refuse to sign something that gives away the store.
Yeah.
And if so, then the tax cuts expire and everybody else. And then maybe after the crisis, we can come back and have a rational policy of helping the middle class, not through those tax cuts, which were basically just a disguise for tax cuts for the wealthy.
Let me ask you one more question, then we'll get back to our callers here. And this is this notion of tax fairness. Does it make sense to treat all income, whether it comes from investments, whether it comes from, you know, working at a Mickey D's, to treat all that income the same?
I actually think, look, there's an economic case that says that investment income, there is some argument for saying that investment income should be taxed at a lower rate. But I've become increasingly convinced that that case is not very strong, and it's actually dwarfed by the case for just taxing income as income, if nothing else, because once you start taxing income differently depending on where it comes from, you create an enormous incentive for people to try to play games, to try to make income manifest itself in different ways. So I say it just goes to a straight income tax that taxes all income the same, and that income tax should be progressive because it makes a great deal of sense to take a higher bite out of the highest incomes, including substantially higher taxes on really top incomes, which, by the way, I'm doing well enough that the policy I advocate would actually hit me reasonably hard financially, although it wouldn't hit me nearly as hard as it would hit Mitt Romney, but I'm fine with that.
Let me get Larry from Bala Cynwyd to join our conversation. And Larry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, Professor Krugman, you've had an excellent track record calling macro trends and interest rate trends over the past few years. Have you given any thought to going to work for a hedge fund or consulting and proving your enemies wrong?
Oh, gosh. If that was what I wanted to do with my life, I should have done that a long time ago, right?
You probably wouldn't have won a Nobel Prize, though, if you had done that.
That's right. Look, realistically, I have enough income to buy everything I need, everything that my wife needs, everything that my family needs. And beyond that, it's all about proving something. I don't need one of those mansions that have been going up that's bigger than the Taj Mahal. So not what I'm interested in doing with what's left of my working life.
Good try, Larry. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. This is a little bit in the weeds here, but I was reading about some kind of I don't know if it's a real argument or kind of a faux argument that you might be having with David Brooks. You both write for the New York Times. Do you two scrap about economic financial issues?
Well, first of all, we both work for the New York Times, but
you never see each other.
But David is based in Washington, and I actually am almost never in the Times building because right. I'm also teaching at Princeton, so I actually work from Central New Jersey. So, here's the way I put it: the Times. So I'm going to puff my employer here. The Times has become so much the dominant forum for interesting discussion in the U.S. press. The Times op-ed page is so dominant over all others that any major debate we're going to have about economics or politics or almost anything is bound to be a debate that's between two New York Times columnists. So, of course, they're going to find stuff where David Brooks and I are taking very different positions. That's actually good. That's actually saying – that's actually more power to the Times.
But one of the arguments is that you argue data – and he argues through storytelling. And I don't know, sounds like that's sort of how you see the world.
I mean, I try to do stories when I can, but yeah, I'm somebody, I'm an economist at deep inside my inner life is all funny diagrams and equations and statistics, and I just pretend to be an actual human being on the outside. So sure, that's the way I do it. But it's also truly true that especially America is such a big place and such a complex place that you can find a human story to illustrate any point you want. Right, you can find you can find a mathematician who became a terrorist, and then you can say, "Well, see, mathematicians are terrorists." But that's so you have to go with the data to do it right. You have to go and say, "All right, but what is the typical case? What actually goes on?" And that's why I'll try my illustrative stories, but anecdotes are never good enough. You do need to look at those data.
Let me get John from Princeton to join us on Radio Times. And John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Mr. Krugman's, but I had a question about Greece.
Sure.
There doesn't seem to be, I watched the BBC and other outlets, none of the Greek parties are really talking about how to change the whole system. I mean, they have major structural problems, and I don't see why not just remove Greece from the euro. Everyone talks about the knock-on effect then to Spain and Italy, but Spain doesn't have these fundamental problems that Greece seems to have in terms of competitiveness, labor costs, overstaffed government, false statistics. I mean, they have some issues about having to rejig their competitiveness. but they don't have these problems that Greece does, and Greece doesn't seem to be interested in addressing them. None of the political parties do.
Well, John,
and the Germans and everyone else aren't going to pay for Greece forever.
Well, John,
it's not going to happen.
I appreciate the call. I'm watching the clock, and I know Paul Krugman wants to respond. Go ahead.
Yeah, so let me give you the – I mean, Greece certainly has big problems. Of course, but they had big problems 15 years ago, and yet they were not in this kind of crisis. So it is a very specific set of circumstances involving joining the euro, now being stuck with this currency and no options, that make it so terrible right now. Spain has got big problems too, not on the same scale. The Spaniards are much better behaved politically than the Greeks. But the point, I think, is that by the way, I think Greece is going to exit the euro. I think we've pretty much run out of options there. And the reason why that's frightening is because the euro was supposed to be irreversible. And once it turns out that it's not, then there will be a run on Spanish and Italian banks, which will require either that the European Central Bank step up with very large loans to contain it, or that they let the whole euro blow apart. So Greece may be Greece is sui generis. Greece is very different from the others. It is the actual sinner among a group of mostly innocent victims of this crisis. But still, it's going to matter. And there's no clean way to do this. This is going to be a moment of truth. But I actually think that the Greek story, as far as the euro, is pretty nearly over. I don't see how it stays in.
I want to quote something briefly that you wrote, a blog you wrote January 6, 2009, about what you described as a weak stimulus plan, that it would limit the rise of unemployment and things would stay pretty bad. And then Mitch McConnell would say, see, government spending doesn't work. And you wrote, let's hope I've got this wrong. Do you think you got it wrong or got it right?
Unfortunately, I got it right. I am really sick of being Cassandra, because if people remember the legend of Cassandra, she was given the gift of prophecy. She was always right, and nobody would ever believe her. And I'm not always right, but I've been right more than I'd like to, and unfortunately, nobody has been believing me in time.
And does the White House call you for advice?
I talk to them.
You do?
Yes, I do talk to people at the White House. I can't be an advisor. Times rules wouldn't permit it, but I do talk to them. They're reasonable people. They've made some mistakes, I think. They still don't obviously agree with me on everything. But these are not bad people in the White House. They're not stupid people. So you take what you can get.
Well, Paul Krugman, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The book is called End This Depression Now, and he joined us from the studios at Princeton University, the Princeton University Broadcast Center. He's a professor there and, won the Nobel Prize in Economics, and he writes a twice-weekly column for the New York Times. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times as well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be right back.